I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology. There was nobody who understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology, providing information to help you change hearts and minds, moving innovations to application with communication.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things we can do for people and the planet. I'm Kevin Folta, and today we're going to talk with one of my colleagues here at the University of Florida, someone who, are you still a colleague?
Yes.
Yes, I'm still a colleague.
You're an emeritus colleague.
Well, that's just a technical issue.
No, of course. Dr. Kurt Hanna. Professor Hanna has been here at the University of Florida since when?
I started in January of 1974.
So it's January 1974, and you're still here.
I'm still here.
And and you retired like 20 years ago or something.
It was officially retired 9 years ago, January.
Yeah, but you still hang around and writing grants.
Writing papers. Sent off a grant proposal this morning, in fact.
Awesome.
traveling to China next month to give a talk, so.
Yeah, so still very much active as faculty. Right. And you've been part of the faculty. You come to faculty meetings. And it's one of the great things about being in this department is because it's you and Gloria Moore, Paul Irene. We have these faculty who have been here and spent their careers here, yet still stick around and continue to contribute in a really, really big way. Still teaching classes?
Still teach. Ironically, Paul Irene and I were graduate students together at the University of Wisconsin. So we started long before Florida being... interactors.
Wow, that's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me a little bit about... So today we're going to talk about sweet corn. And back in maybe episode 58, we spoke with Jed Dobley about corn in general and where it came from, its general evolution. And we talked about the different kinds of field corn and flint corn, that kind of thing. So people who are really interested in that might want to go back to that. But let's start with just that first, and then we'll talk about how your career introgressed into that. What is the difference between sweet corn and corn?
The fundamental difference is there's a buildup of sugar in sweet corns, whereas you get a buildup of starch in all other corns, field corn. Number two, yellow, is grown in the Midwest. But that's a fundamental difference. There are other differences as well. There is pericarp thickness because of taking a bite. And then there's some differences that are kind of subtle. For example, with field corn, you don't care how much force it takes to pull the ear off the stalk. Sweet corn, that's a characteristic because the huge majority of sweet corn is harvested by hand. There are beautiful stories of people breeding excellent hybrids, and then they tried to harvest it, and it took a lot of energy to pull the ear off the stalk, and that was the end of that hybrid. So there are traits that are important in sweet corn that are not important in field corn. The color of the flag leaf or the ear leaf. In some markets, that leaf is attached. They want a nice green ear. For field corn, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the general idea when we talk about field corn is that this is the stuff that we think about that is grown throughout the Midwest that's primarily used for animal feed or ethanol, that kind of thing.
Correct.
Yeah, and this is the stuff that really is the backbone when we think about corn. Sweet corn is how much of the market, in general?
I don't know the exact numbers. I would guess... 1%, 2%, yeah. Something like that. It's very minor compared to field corn. It's large if you live in Florida or in the, well, actually in Minnesota, Wisconsin, for processed corn, the canned corn. It's a big crop there as well. But no, it's not nearly as big as field corn. But it's an important crop in certain areas.
Are most growers growing this as, say, an adjunct to the field corn operation that you can have a roadside stand and something like that? I mean, it used to be in DeKalb that you'd see that all the time.
Right. Yeah, there are these roadside operations. Some farmers do it. It's kind of a side, almost a side job kind of thing. We on our home farm in Indiana, we grow an acre of corn, sweet corn, but it's for the neighbors and the family, and some people show up, we don't even know. They know we grow it, and they come out and pick it. So,
like, are these the famous corn drifters we hear about?
Well, yeah, that's a good way of... we like to be good neighbors, and the corn's there for people to take.
That's pretty cool. And then, as you've said, the family farm, and that it's always worth noting that you, not only are you a famous professor, but you're also a farmer. I mean, you do it.
I go back for the harvest. I spend time up there, help make some of the decisions. We sell about 15,000 hogs a year, farm 2,000 acres. So my nephew actually runs the shop, but...
You just wrecked the combines?
Yeah, I've had some issues with combines. Burned one up, ran another one into a tree. There are stories up there.
Well, the majority of the story in terms of your experience with sweet corn comes from really your life's work and understanding the starch biosynthesis and how that was working inside the kernel, because really when you're looking at starch biosynthesis, you're looking at accumulation of a carbohydrate that other mechanisms then take over and can convert to other compounds, the sugars.
Correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about that work so that we have a background for how this proceeds?
Okay. It's an interesting story. When I interviewed here in late 1973, the University of Florida had just released a couple of sweet corns based on a gene called Shrunken 2, which gives a lot more sugar than the old traditional sweet corns. And so it was a big topic of discussion here. And I came down and gave a seminar on how the Shrunken 2 gene functioned at the biochemical level. So the tie-in was immediate. And from that point on, then I had an interest in the sweet corn breeding program here at Florida, which, as you know, up until recently was solely based in Belgrade, and now partially in Gainesville with Marcio Resende here.
Yeah.
But that was my kind of my first introduction to sweet corn, and I stayed connected and at different levels over the years with the sweet corn breeding program here.
And maybe we're dancing around a lot, but it does make sense that people don't realize that Florida produces a lot of sweet corn.
Yes, a lot of sweet corn. What Florida has going for it, of course, it's not the soil types, and it's not the... We have all kinds of bugs pathogens because we don't have killing winters. But we have heat when other people don't, so we can produce crops when they can't be produced in the Midwest. So it's grown here and shipped north, and we fill a niche.
Yeah, so our season is really maybe planting in February and harvesting throughout April, May, that kind of...
Right. And then they can actually even go further south out of the Belgrade area down into the south of Miami,
yeah,
and basically grow corn there all year long. But they grow it to fit a niche, a market niche.
Yeah, so it's a higher value during those
higher
windows
because yeah.
You can never outcompete the Midwest ultimately.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
Do they still sell to Europe?
Yes. A lot of corn, believe it or not, is picked in South Florida, put on ships, and shipped to Europe. I've often wondered what that corn tastes like time it gets to Europe, but it sells. And this, of course, has been an issue with the GMOs because we can't ship to Europe, hence they can't grow GMOs in South Florida.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that at the end. That's kind of an important point. So when you're talking about Shrunken 2, What does it do?
Then there'll be a quiz on this in a few minutes.
That's right. Yeah. At the end.
Yeah. It's the large subunit of an enzyme called adenosine diphosphoglucose pyrophosphorylase, and this enzyme makes a nucleotide sugar called ADP glucose, and the glucose of that then is used to synthesize the starches amylose, amylopectin, and as well as phytoglycogen. Phytoglycogen is an important one because it gives the creaminess to certain sweet corns, the creamy taste in your mouth.
Okay, so when you have a mutation in this large subunit.
Right. When you have a mutation, then you knock it out, and hence you don't convert the sugars to starch. So it's kind of a roadblock in this pathway. So you build up stuff that normally would be converted.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. So the plant, as we know through photosynthesis, is making sugars.
Right.
And then the plant assembles these into starches using these enzyme complexes, or using this enzyme. And then in this case, when you mutate that enzyme, you're not taking those simpler sugars and making complex starches.
Right.
And now we have sweet, and that means sweet corn.
Correct. That's hence the term. Yeah, sweet corn.
Why did they call it shrunken too?
The first person who described the mutant looked at the kernel and said, "That looks shrunken." So the first one was called shrunken one. This was shrunken two. Then there's shrunken three, shrunken four. Interestingly, other people looked at the same phenotype, the same shrunken kernel. They called it brittle. So there's brittle one, brittle two, brittle three. It's all the same phenotype, and in fact, I said the large subunit, there's a small subunit, you knock that out, you get a kernel that looks exactly like it, but that gene's called brittle 2.
Yeah.
So, it goes back to the original people who named these genes, and it's stuck, and we're not going to change nomenclature.
Well, who was the person behind this originally?
Interesting point. The these came out of the 40s. Shrunken 2 actually came from the University of Michigan by a guy by the name of Maines, M-A-I-N-S, published the work in 1943. And the shrunken one gene had been published at that time, and he figured out this wasn't shrunken one, so he called it shrunken two. Now, the person who then realized this was good for sweet corn was a fellow in Illinois by the name of John Lawnin, who we lost several years ago, but he was actually a good friend of mine. And he was using it as a genetic marker for some genetic studies, and he happened to taste it, and it tasted sweet. And so he ran the sugars, and he thought, this might be a pretty good sweet corn, because the sweet corns up to that point had a mutant gene called sugar1, elevates the sugar, but not nearly to the extent that knocking out shrunken 2 does. So he developed the first commercial shrunken 2-based sweet corn. It was called Illini Extra Sweet. It was good. It lacked plant vigor. So it didn't really catch on commercially. But then a breeder here in Florida, the name of Emil Wolf, knew of John's work. And given the Florida market, where the corn is harvested and then the time between harvest and consumption is in days or weeks, you need something with a phenomenal shelf life, a higher sugar to start with. So Emil took the shrunken two and put it in a different genetic background. Actually has a three-way cross in there. And so the first commercially useful shrunken 2 corn actually came out of the University of Florida in the work of Emil Wolf. Now shrunken 2 has basically taken over the world market. There's still some sugary corns around combined with some other genes, but they're minor players in the whole thing.
And so sugary one, is that a different mechanism, or is it allele in the same gene?
No, it's an interesting, the sugary one gene encodes an enzyme that actually debranches starch polymers.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting here was if you knock out an enzyme that debranches starch, you make more starch. It was counterintuitive how this thing works. But when the gene was cloned, and it turned out to be a debranching enzyme, and there are models for why this is probably, losing this. Well, what goes on is you make highly branched starch, and you can't package it as well. You can't get as much in there. So you have to put a lot of branches in, then you cleave certain branches. The branch points are in clusters, and so then you can make more starch. But it was counterintuitive. Again, the powers of having mutants.
Right.
You know. So yeah, it's an intriguing. It's all very intriguing. How we make that molecule.
Well, that's starch, and that's something for people who maybe don't know a lot about starch. It's a molecule that's assembled, or a polymer that's assembled from monomers that are put together in very specific ways, maybe end to end, but then in some cases they're put together side to side or top to bottom if you look at it, you know, on a piece of paper.
Right.
And the idea is that that's kind of the where those debranching enzymes really make an effect.
Right.
So you get these more linear ones that aren't branching side to side.
Right.
And so that dramatically changes the what starch is.
Right.
And in this case, that sugary one that was doing that.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting story. If you don't take these things out, you get a soluble polysaccharide like bacteria have. So can you imagine what plant life would have been like if the polysaccharides had been soluble? You could never dry a seed down, for example. You could never get the weight. Plant agriculture would have been totally different had it not been for these debranching enzymes. So
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we'll talk about some of the other issues about sweet corn here in the state of Florida and everywhere else, where the future is going and what the new genetics look like. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll be back with Dr. Kurt Hanna in just a few minutes.
Hello, Talking Biotech listeners. My name is Nick Syke. And I wanted to take just a quick moment to tell you about No Ideas Media. That's No with a K and a W. It's a media company I've recently started, and its express purpose is to have pragmatic conversations about divisive topics. And I'm willing to bet that since you're here listening to a biotechnology podcast right now, you'd probably agree that a pragmatic conversation about this topic could benefit a lot of people, especially when we're talking about biotechnology in food, the dreaded GMO. This is the first topic I wanted No Ideas Media to focus on, and I wanted to learn it pretty well. So I traveled like all over the place, Hawaii to Uganda. I interviewed a shwaka experts, including this pretty awesome guy you might have heard of named Kevin Folta. I'm making videos with all these interviews, and I'd love you to check them out. You can find them by searching No Ideas Media on YouTube or Facebook. Remember, that's No as in knowledge. Every week you'll find a new video featuring some exciting expert or topic to do with genetically engineered food, and the videos are perfect for people who aren't super familiar with the science, so I would really encourage you to share them, especially with people you know who need to take a look at this scary topic of GMO a little more pragmatically. Also, if you want to get in on a surprisingly constructive conversation about this topic, and maybe even contribute to changing a few minds, follow No Ideas Media on Facebook and get in on the conversations there. It also really helps us if you subscribe to the No Ideas Media YouTube channel. Plus, that way you'll always know when there's something new and exciting to watch and share. And I mean, let's face it, we all want to be in the know, right? That's why you're listening to this podcast, after all, which I think I'll let you get back to about now. Thanks a lot.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast. Today, talking about the molecular basis or the biochemical basis of what makes sweet corn sweet and what makes sweet corn different from regular field corn. And we're speaking with an expert on this, and that's Dr. Kurt Hanna here from the University of Florida, and someone I've known for a long time, 15 years plus. And,
yeah, something like that. Yeah. I was on the committee that that made you the offer, in fact.
That's right. I remember the first night we had dinner at Mildred's. But so we're talking about the kind of the basis of sweet corn and what makes it sweet and what makes it different. And we talked a lot about the different genes that were playing a role in this process. But there's also this thing, well, the shrunken 2 is this major allele that really revolutionized the entire sweet corn industry, right? That was a big deal.
Yes.
And what was sweet corn like? We talked about sugary 1, but even before that, but were people, how did they come across sweet corn in the first place?
Interesting question. Probably the world's expert on that is a good friend of ours, Bill Tracy. Mm-hmm. And Bill's hypothesis is that the sugary one originally was not used because it was sweet, but they would get it in the dough stage and eat it in the dough stage. It was a little sweeter. The properties of the corn made it better for all kinds of things. So it was first used as in the dough stage, and then people realized it was sweeter. And there were actually 5 different cases of domestication, or 5 different mutant alleles of sugary 1 that have been found throughout America. And he thinks each one of those was a domestication event.
Mm-hmm.
And by domestication, I mean a mutant that happened, and then people realized it had advantages, and they propagated it and used it.
Yeah, we talk a lot about domestication on the podcast, and I've heard Bill talk about that sweet corn, or corn in general, was the sweetness in the diet, because people in the indigenous peoples in North America and Central America didn't have sugar beets, and you didn't have other forms of sweetness. And so you really were getting it from corn, which, you know, isn't, we don't think of as overly sweet, but these were the alleles that when they popped up.
Right, right.
Yeah, they probably really played a role in shaping the domestication process.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, shrunken 2 didn't go through that kind of window.
Oh, that's true.
It was, and I think I know why. I mean, it was picked up because of genetics. It was around as actually a genetic marker. And then it was the geneticist who figured out, okay, this has a commercial use. The reason I think that is the case is that the shrunken 2 block is much more severe in the pathway than the sugary 1 block, and the mutant itself has all kinds of germination problems. So it's going to be lost just because it can't germinate very well.
Yeah, that's the obvious question. If people are selecting for sweetness, why would they miss the mutations in the gene that makes it the sweetest?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I think they probably, some people had it, but they couldn't propagate it. And that's been a problem in the sweet corn industry as well when it was first being used. The reason John Lonnon's hybrid didn't really make it was they had germination issues. And one of the things that our Emil Wolf did was get these things in genetic backgrounds that gave adequate germination for commercial use. We've played in that arena by getting a shrunken 2 allele that splits the difference, an allele we call shrunken 2i. So the block in the first allele that came out of University of Michigan and John Lonnon worked with is an allele we call shrunken 2r. R for reference, meaning the first mutant that described the gene. That's a total block in the pathway. There's still starch there, a little bit of starch, and we just sent a paper off to Plant Cell giving how we think that starch gets there. We think it actually gets there not by the use of pyrophosphorylase, but by use of other enzymes, perhaps sucrose synthase or starch phosphorylase. But this double-edged sword of having a kernel that's really, really sweet that people like to eat, but also having a mature seed that will germinate, it's the sweeter it is, the more problems you have with germination. So this shrunken 2i allele kind of splits the difference. It has a milder phenotype at the eating stage, but it germinates very well.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and one of the intriguing things about that is I think the mouth, you can saturate the sweetness reaction in the mouth. Even at the optimal eating stage, shrunken 2i does not have the sugar levels of the original shrunken 2 allele. It has a milder phenotype at the eating stage, but it germinates a whole lot better. And interestingly, while there's a difference in sugar content of SHRCA2i versus the original allele, the mouth cannot distinguish those. So the mouth reads it as being just as sweet. It's not a naturally occurring allele. It came from chemical mutagenesis. The pollen were treated with a chemical mutagen that killed half the pollen or more. And this came out of the, this was a mutant pulled out of there. We know exactly what the sequence difference is in this allele, and we know why it's leaky. But, and this allele was backcrossed into other corns, but God only knows what other mutations came along with it.
Let's drill down on that a little bit, because you said a lot of things there that might perk up the ears of the average listener. You got leaky alleles, and so let's go back.
So you
were looking for other versions of the shrunken two allele.
Correct.
And so one way to do that might be to use, and at the time, when was this that you did that mutagenesis?
Actually, it was done in a different lab, and it was sent to us, and we realized what could be done with it. So this was done in the 70s.
Okay, so in the 70s, what you would do would be, and this is probably from the 40s to the 70s, even before, you would use chemicals that would mutate DNA,
right,
specific bases, or you would use radiation.
So radiation was another one, yes.
So use fast neutron or
X-rays.
X-rays.
Even.
And you would put seed or pollen or whatever in those fields or in those chemicals, and you would cause damage to DNA. Then in the next generation or whatever you would plant out, you'd find most of the stuff was dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because
correct,
it was just hammered with mutations and couldn't function.
Right.
Yet some small amount would survive, and out of the survivors, you would occasionally see some useful trait.
Exactly.
And maybe the rest of the plant is totally garbage. Like, it would grow horribly and it was sick, but gosh, it made a lot of sugar in the corn, in the
right,
kernels.
Right.
So now you knew you had something special in there. Now you had to do what they call backcrossing, where you cross that screwed up plant, if you can, against maybe a really good plant and try to bring in that new favorable gene, while kind of with every round of backcrossing against a different elite plant, kind of getting rid of the garbage while keeping the good stuff.
Exactly.
And so this is when you're talking about having alleles and then doing the back crosses. All you're really doing is crossing against a good parent to get rid of all the garbage and keep the traits that you want.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's where we are. And so you're talking about the shrunken 2i being a leaky allele. And what does that mean?
Leaky means it had some function. In contrast to the original mutant that was a total loss of function, this one had some function.
Okay, and then the other part about this was, what chemical word did they use?
Ethylmethane sulfonate.
Ah, the old EMS.
The old EMS.
Yeah, super nasty stuff.
Oh, it's toxic.
And and it changes, it affects specific DNA bases.
Right.
And what's beautiful about that is, at the right concentration, you can do an awful lot of damage and create a lot of new traits.
Exactly.
So even this one that you've backcrossed dozens and dozens of times, perhaps, still has a lot of the baggage coming along from that damage, because anything in the genetic neighborhood of the mutation that you want, there still may be lots of other changes that you never anticipated.
Exactly. Exactly. So there are a lot of possible unknowns coming along with this.
Yeah, collateral issues.
Yeah, and this is all under the banner of conventional plant breeding, which we look at as being safe and no issues.
And warm and fuzzy and lovable.
Warm and fuzzy. And at the University of Florida patented this gene. It went to the market. No concern at all about safety. So if you equate danger with unknowns, you know, this is not a,
And patents?
We have a patent on it. And,
so it's got all of it.
Because we have the sequences on it. Yeah. Yeah, this is a patent on a gene that's not a transgene.
Yeah.
This idea that transgenics led to plant patenting. You know when you could first legally patent a plant?
Well, I was going to say 1937.
1930.
Oh, that's a little bit off.
The Plant Protection Act was signed in 1930.
1930, okay.
The Plant Variety Protection Act was signed in 1970.
Okay.
So long before transgenes.
I knew there was a
along.
Seven in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's always a really important point, that here people have been patenting genes because they have value commercially.
Correct.
And the way that you're able to survive as a breeding program is to patent these things and be able to have a little money come back to the program to be able to seed the next generation of research.
Right.
It's really hard to get money to do breeding research.
Exactly.
Because it takes, you know, I was down at our Citrus Research Center yesterday, and you're talking to scientists here who've been spending 15, 20, 30 years to generate new lines of citrus. And how much it costs for them to do that, what fields and fields of trees. It's enormously expensive. And they're just starting to see returns coming back to their programs now, which
right.
is great.
Right.
But back to Shrunken 2i. So this thing has, it's a patented gene. It is kind of half functional, and it gives you a comparable sense of sweetness in the kernel.
Correct. If eaten at the optimal time, you know, with not very long storage and things like that, mm-hmm. with time you can distinguish the two.
Yeah.
And what the companies have done is they've combined it, Shrunk2i with a sugary mutation and things like that. So you start stacking these mutants. So yeah, it's been sales are going up and up and up. The downside is the patent's running out. So,
well, how many more years is that?
I think it's got 1 year.
One more year.
I don't want the companies to hear that. I just hope they keep paying.
Yeah, they should anyway.
Yeah, they should, but they probably have lawyers who watch that kind of stuff.
No, they probably have a big X on the calendar, if you're asking me. You know how they work, right?
Yeah.
But so we talked about this whole idea of mutagenesis and creating the genetic changes just by using mutagens.
Right.
But, you know, we also said that there's no genetically engineered sweet corn sold in Florida. So first, let's talk about how much of the national sweet corn is genetically engineered. Is any of it?
Yeah, they sell it in these U-pick operations in the Midwest because the market is local. It's not going to go out of the country. So there's Roundup Ready corn and there's BT corn out there. And these are sold on roadside kinds of things. Anything where there's not a chance that the corn would leave the country, it's fair game.
Yeah, I've had some actually. I got some at a farmer's market from, actually they were specifically showcasing Monsanto lines. I think it was Obsidian, is that the sweet corn? Anyway, whatever the sweet corn line was, they were selling at this farmer's market. They were selling as a local locally produced version of that particular corn line. They were talking very proudly about the sources of the different seeds and things like that. And I ate them and I didn't die or anything. Just fine. So if these things are available and they're cutting insecticide use because of BT and changing the, not using atrazine or whatever else you would use if you didn't have Roundup.
Correct.
Why don't we do that here in Florida?
The big issue is that some of this corn is shipped to Europe. So because there's a European connection, the growers will not grow any transgenic corn.
And so how do they get around the problems that would normally be mitigated by a transgene?
Spray and spray and spray.
So you use traditional insect controls.
Correct.
Rather than genetic insect controls.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, you and I have both spent time down there, and when I'm at Belglade, I know it's time to get up because I hear the spray planes out.
Yeah.
You know, because they'll come out at daylight. And so, you know.
It's pretty amazing. I think if people saw that, you really do appreciate how much a genetic solution can mitigate the use of chemical controls.
Right.
And you know, it's not that the chemical controls, and we should stress, I mean, those things are used safely, the corn's perfectly fine.
Right.
But it's a question of you're growing corn in really a harsh environment. You're
right.
growing these, you know, Florida is ground zero for every critter in the world and mm-hmm. everything that wants to destroy fruits and vegetables. And so you have to go to these extreme measures to combat it. And how much money the industry might save, how much more affordable the product might be, who knows?
And the carbon footprint.
The carbon, certainly.
You know, because all the fuel and stuff that they use to have to put these sprays on, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's all kinds of good reasons to do it. And I would hope that one of these days we'll let science reign and we'll do this stuff. But
don't count on it.
I know. I'm 72 years old. I don't know that I'll live long enough to see it.
I think you'll be surprised. I don't know. What else is new for, what else is happening in sweet corn now, and what can consumers look forward to in the future for improvements or maybe new varieties?
Well, you know, some problems never go away. Disease resistance and things like that. What I don't think people realize is Darwinian evolution is real. And when people breed by conventional genetics, conventional breeding, resistance to a pathogen or something, that resistance will hold for a while. But the pathogen is smaller, it reproduces much quicker, it's a numbers game. And eventually the pathogen will overcome the plant resistance and we're back to breeding for more resistance. I remember as a graduate student at Purdue, there was a program there breeding wheat for an insect resistance, and they'd come up with resistant materials by conventional breeding. But they never stopped breeding. They knew it would last about 5 years and would break down. Mm-hmm. And they'd need more stuff. So this kind of, and we've seen this thing with the BT and Roundup resistant weeds. I mean, it's the same concept. So these kinds of things are ongoing. They'll, you know, breeding for pest resistance is still a big issue. You know, I've talked about some of the traits, ear placement on the stalk, ease of pulling off the ear.
How big they are, how they fit in a cart.
South Florida. Yeah, interesting point. In South Florida, they have to be a certain length and a certain width to fit into their boxes.
Yeah.
So that's a constraint on commercial sweet corn that you don't have, say, for roadside sales and stuff like that, or garden corn.
Oh, very true.
You know, you don't care. You know, if you have a garden, you go out and pick corn to eat. You don't really care how long the ear is or how thick it is or any of those kinds of things.
Well, that's very true. And that was one of the things I found so striking, because when I first landed here, when I first was doing the chair job, I started to, I was down there with Steve Sargent and Rob Berger was, and you were down there too. And we're talking about, and that was two of the lines that were being released as hybrids. And one of the big traits was that it was superior for packing. It just fit better in a box. But these are the things that people don't think about when they think about sweet corn.
Right.
And one
right.
of the reasons that it's important to do the podcast. So.
Right. Well, and because of all these traits, The sweet corn germplasm is very narrow because it's been under selection for all these traits, so it gets smaller and smaller. One of the nice things about the revolution we're seeing with DNA and DNA sequencing and marking and markers is now we can feasibly incorporate genes from field corn into sweet corn and do it in an efficient way by using markers. So we're going to see more and more of that, of useful genes in field corn being transferred into sweet corn.
And then that's where the program's going here now, right?
Correct.
And so we last year hired Dr. Marcio Resende, who is really works with genomic selection and uses more computationally, statistically based methods to make breeding choices and to study populations and identify individuals that have a higher likelihood of being superior or having superior combinations of genetics.
Right.
So really, really good stuff and really exciting to see where things are going.
Yeah.
And anything that you would like to see happen in the next couple of years, like, you know, or...
Well, other than people come to their senses on GMOs and things like that, that would be nice. I mean, people can accept climate change and the causes, and yet some of those same people have a hard time accepting the science behind GMOs. I've continued to be, I don't know.
Amazed. Disgusted.
Disgusted.
I think I understand this, though. And I think I got it, because think of it like this. when you're, and it goes back to that, that all that stuff that Dan Kahneman talks about system one and system two thinking. So the reptile brain, you know, the in the middle of the head that's controlling fast responses to threats, and then the more cognitive executive function, which is more processing, and things like vaccination, climate, they all appeal to that cognitive function. You can put together evidence and get some sort of data out, some sort of conclusion that makes sense. When you're talking about food, you're talking about something that's hitting the reptile brain, the lowest rung on the Maslow hierarchy of needs, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a certain weirdness that comes along with any time you're talking about food. And when we live in a place of great abundance and low cost, there's no impetus to take a risk.
True.
And so you it all goes in that lowest part of the brain, and triggers those sense of threats and sense of dread, and sense of something unusual. So I think that's where we have to really think about this going forward, is how do we, and I've talked about this all the time when we talk about science communication, is how do we make food technology not threatening?
Well, part of this, though, is people don't understand what goes on in conventional plant breeding.
Right.
You know, if people
God.
Really, that's kind of like making sausage. You know, I've often said if you ask the typical person in Miami what they think of plant breeding, they would say it's a perverted sex act that should be outlawed.
That's right.
You know?
No, they do it just fine on their own.
Yeah. So,
well, that was like the first time I started to learn about strawberry breeding, and I looked online because one of the popular Florida cultivars is Sweet Charlie.
Yeah.
And so I looked up emasculation Sweet Charlie, and you don't want to know what I found. It was not a I thought, I do not want to be a plant breeder. I'm not wearing that outfit.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that I think is the, what people, you know, the Shaka 2-Eye story, you know, there are these unknowns of these genetic changes that could be coming along there. People don't have a clue that kind of stuff goes on. So,
but you're doing, you're participating in that correction. And I mean, you've written for Genetic Literacy Project.
Right.
You've been active in GMO Answers, right?
GMO Answers.
In other places.
Yeah. I've been called a Monsanto shill many times. I take that as a badge of honor.
Yeah. Means that you're creating some new information that's making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope.
So you got to. So if people did want to find you on social media, are you active on Twitter still? Or you?
I have an account there. I'm Florida Corn Man on Twitter. But to be honest, I don't really know how to use Twitter all that well.
Okay, well, so follow Florida Corn Man.
Yeah.
And once he has a few thousand followers, then maybe he'll be excited to learn how to use it.
Yeah.
And I'll help you.
Maybe off air here you can help me with.
Yeah, we can do that.
Figuring out how to do that.
So that's maybe the best way. It's one way people could get in touch with you. But you're also on the website here at the University of Florida.
Right, and Facebook.
Things like that. Okay.
And I'm an expert for GMO Answers. And I get on the Genetic Literacy Project now and then. So I need to do more of that. And if I kind of slow down professionally, I plan on getting more active in that stuff.
Well, in the unlikely event you slow down professionally. I've been hearing you're quitting now for 8 years.
I know. It's becoming embarrassing. But,
That's good, though, because, you know, the world needs more Kurt Hannas. And so, you know, very grateful for you taking the time to talk to us today. And maybe we'll catch up with you again in 10 more years.
See what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll take on chestnut breeding or some project like that.
Well, thank you very much for talking to
us. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.